From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Many eastern cities, including Washington, D.C. and New York, have extensive bike share networks where you can pay a small fee, pick up a bicycle, ride it, and return it to the same or another station. Baltimore is trying to catch up. We asked two bike advocates whether a small bike share can have big results. Then Dee Watkins is a young, fluid writer from East Baltimore. He tells us why he named his new book of essays The Beast Side and why he wrote about literacy, inequality, and barriers of culture between whites and blacks. Plus, in many cultures, tradition includes naturally fermented foods, from beer and miso soup to yogurt and sourdough bread. Sander Katz, who wrote The Art of Fermentation, joins Tom Hall to talk about his workshop and the benefits of bacteria. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. First, a programming note. Before Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake shook up Baltimore government and politics with her announcement that she would not seek re-election, she had agreed to sit down with us for most of our show this coming Friday. She still plans to come to WIPR, and we'd like to hear what you'd like her to address. What has she not been asked that you think is important? You can call our Google Voice line at 410-881-3162 with your ideas. Or send an email to mdmorning@wypr.org. Again, the phone number is 410-881-3162. You can also tweet at us. Our handle is @MarylandMorning. And now, today's story, one of the mayor's priorities, setting up a bike share program. Baltimore is trying to catch up with quite a few big eastern cities with expansive systems that let people borrow a bike for a small fee and return it to the same spot or another station. Washington, D.C. was one of the first bike share programs 5 years ago. Since then, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh all have built robust bike shares. Last week, Mayor Rawlings-Blake said the city is seeking a vendor to supply 250 bikes and 25 bike share stations in Charm City. Liz Cornish, executive director of Bike More, a nonprofit that advocates for making Baltimore more bike-friendly, is here to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And also here is John Laria. His day job is as a lawyer, but he also chairs the Mayor's Bicycle Advisory Commission. Welcome.
Hello.
John Laria, 250 bikes is small. It's about one-tenth of the number of bikes in D.C.'s bike share program. Can a bike share be implemented piecemeal, or is it really more something that ought to be go big or go home?
Well, we need to start somewhere, and 250 bikes at about 25 stations is a good place to start. I know people have said we should have a bigger program, and someday I suspect we will, but those bikes are really intended to be spread across the east to west in the downtown core, stretching up to maybe Penn Station, including the Hopkins Medical Institutions in East Baltimore, going from the Biopark on the west side to Canton on the east side, and perhaps up to Hopkins University, although that starts to become a little bit of a stretch for how people use a bike share program. But I think it's a good place to start. And frankly, it's really cost driven. And if we have additional resources, as we hope to have, we'll expand as quickly as we possibly can.
Liz Cornish, I want to talk about the relation, if there is any, between the planned bike share program and the city's network of dedicated bike lanes. How many bike lanes does Baltimore have?
Well, right now we have about 100 miles of bike lanes, and then the Downtown Bicycle Network will add significantly more once it's implemented. Of particular note is the Maryland Avenue Protected Bicycle Lane, which will be a 2.6-mile facility. It'll begin at 29th Street and terminate at Light Street. That'll be the largest protected facility in the city once that's constructed in the spring of 2016. In terms of how bike share relates to that, from an advocacy perspective, we really like bike share because there's really nothing better to promote the urgency of creating a bicycle network than getting new riders on comfortable, easy-to-use bicycles and having the increase of ridership kind of raise awareness that there are people on the road and they need to be accommodated. That being said, you really have to take a two-pronged approach as a city. So I think the timing of the implementation of Bike Share is good. And so we'll hopefully see the implementation of this program spur the expediency of the creation of additional bicycle facilities.
Sheila, if I might, I think the great thing about both Bike Share and the protected bike lanes is not only do they do the things they do independently, but they also provide probably the most visible manifestation of a city's commitment to biking. Because regular bike lanes are terrific, and we need many more of them. But they're not quite as visible as a truly protected bike lane as you see in D.C. and other cities that are making great progress on this. That plus bike share. When you travel and you hear people come back and they say, boy, that city really had a lot of bike stuff going on, what they often mean is a lot of protected bike lanes and a robust bike share program. So to me, those are two very important things. And by the way, Liz is being a little generous when she says 100 miles of bike lanes. We do have lots of miles of bike lanes, but unfortunately, they're choppier than we want them to be. They are they're not always where you want them to be and to get you to go where you want to go. So we're working on improving the network overall, but the protected bike lane, and particularly the lane on Maryland Avenue from 29th Street to Pratt Street, which is basically a big north-south commuter route, will be a very visible manifestation and a very, very practical place for people to be able to ride their bicycles, both for work and for leisure.
That's John Laria, chair of the Mayor's Bicycle Advisory Commission here on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Liz Cornish, executive director of Bike More, an advocacy group dedicated to making Baltimore a more bike-friendly city. We're talking about plans for a bike share program in Baltimore. I want to listen to a clip from Mayor Rawlings Blake.
The implementation of a successful bike share system will be a boost to our city's transportation network, and it will continue to boost economic development in Baltimore City.
Will 250 bikes really accomplish that?
So that's a really interesting question. So bike share success isn't necessarily tied to the size of the system, but the density of the system. So bike share use is really driven on how readily available are they from the moment I walk out of my front door to how readily available are they at wherever destination I choose to arrive to. So the siting of the stations is going to be critical in the beginning to sort of show that the system is successful, and then that would hopefully drive future investment to create additional stations. So we've seen this start small approach work okay in other cities. Boston is a great example. They started in the Boston Common area and then were able to sort of radiate out. But in terms of 250 bikes actually making a dent in the transportation needs that the city has currently, we don't think that 250 bikes is sufficient.
How do you see it?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be with the mayor at that announcement, and I think the mayor was really talking more generally about bike share as part of a larger bike program. The city just adopted a brand new bike master plan in March. The commission that I chair was created around the same time. So I think the mayor is recognizing what we've been preaching, Liz and I and others, which is that a cycling culture, a bike friendliness, is essential to economic development in a modern American city. It's essential to the attraction of millennials and others. It's essential to retention. And companies all across the city are telling us that their employees want it and we need to provide it to them. So that's really the broader context in which all of this sits. It's not bike share. It's bike share ratcheting up bike lanes, which reflect back and create more opportunities for bike share. And it's sort of a rising tide lifting all bikes.
One of the things the mayor mentioned is opportunities for sponsors, for revenue to come, I guess, to the bike share program. I mean, are there profits to be made here?
Well, the city is putting out a request for a sponsorship company. One of the reasons that bike share has not succeeded in the past in Baltimore, really not the fault of the city, but the fault of the market, which continues to evolve. But one of the flaws has been the need to have some sponsorship for the program. For the first time, the city is seeking a company that whose sole job would be to identify sponsors of stations, ideally a sponsor of the entire system. As you know, in other cities, these systems are sometimes named for a large corporate sponsor. If we're fortunate, we might get someone like that. So that's really the opportunity that's there for us. And I think the approach of having a professional company, which of course is going to be compensated in some way for the work that it does, is really the way to do it.
Well, first I want to go back to the transportation costs, because I think that's really interesting to me. So when you talk about the cost of bike share and especially corporate sponsorship. So one of the things as advocates that we're really wanting to make sure that we get across is that if a bike share system is part of this greater transportation network and amenities that we provide our citizens and our tourists that visit here in Baltimore, we have to really create a metric of success so that we can really understand, is it financially successful? And when you look at traditionally how state and local municipalities pay for transportation, it's heavily subsidized. So you're looking at how much does it cost to actually drive a vehicle, and does that cover the cost to maintain the roads that they use? You're looking at 30% from fees, and that's pretty much the same for transit as well. So we know that we subsidize transit because overall, or transportation in general, because overall it's better for the greater good. We like getting people from A to B. We think it's important. So in terms of deciding whether or not bike share has the potential to be financially successful, or is the initial investment sufficient, I think we also have to really look at what are the metrics at which we're going to measure that financial success of that program, and are we going to hold them to the same standard that we do other forms of transportation? And so when you talk about corporate sponsorship, while corporate sponsorship I think is great because it creates buy-in, it creates enthusiasm for the program, we have to be careful that we're not setting up a bike share system to somehow be successful in a climate that we don't ask other forms of transportation to be successful in. And so that's just something to consider.
One last thing. Helmets. Will people rent helmets along with their bikes, or do they have to bring their own?
Helmets are not required in the state of Maryland. And as a result, we would expect bike share system might provide it as an option, but it's not required. And as a practical matter, many people, particularly if they're going from a business meeting to another business meeting or something like that, won't wear them. Now, it's not Maryland law, but of course, we all recommend it. I ride a helmet. I wear a helmet when I ride my bike. I imagine that Liz does as well. We'll certainly be encouraging safety in all sorts of ways, but I don't think there's going to be any mandatory helmet use. There'll be perhaps ways to make them available for people who want them as an option.
I think the best thing that bike share does for bicycling is it puts people in an upright position on a heavy bike traveling at low speeds. And so this vision of everyday bicycling really starts to bring this idea that this is a solution that not only has the benefits that John outlined, but we're looking at reducing car trips, we're looking at improved congestion or reduced congestion through traffic, we're looking at improved air quality, we're looking at improved public health. So the first year that you start bike commuting, you lose an average of 10 pounds. So this is the sort of thing, the economic benefit or the return on investment, if you will, that increasing the number of bike users in Baltimore can really bring to the city. And I think if you get bogged down in arguments like helmet or no helmet, you really start to miss the bigger picture, which is more people on bikes equals a healthier, more economically vibrant, safer city. And I think that's what we're all interested in investing in.
I really appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Liz Cornish is executive director of Bike More, an advocacy group dedicated to making Baltimore more bike friendly. John Laria, by day, he's a lawyer at Ballard Spahr, but takes on another role as chair of the Mayor's Bicycle Advisory Commission. We've got more information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning. Author Dee Watkins on growing up in East Baltimore. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Dee Watkins is an up-and-coming writer in Baltimore, an up-and-coming black writer. Race is relevant in describing him because race is a big part of what he writes about. He rejects being labeled the voice of young black Baltimore, but he's certainly one of the voices who can explain what's going on. We talked to Dee Watkins last year, as did a lot of other interviewers, when the online magazine Salon published an essay of his, Too Poor for Pop Culture. Now he's collected that and about a dozen other essays into a book, The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. And Dee Watkins is here in the studio. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So The Beast Side, a play on East Side, the east side of Baltimore where you grew up. Still your home?
Still my home. I live in Waverly.
Aside from the vowel rhyme, Beast and East, why Beast?
I grew up in beastly times. I grew up in the height of the crack era. And you almost had to develop a beast-like mentality to make it through that. Murder's not foreign to me. Pain's not foreign to me. All of these things come with everyday survival.
Yeah, that comes through in these essays.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who hasn't lost a family member, a close friend, or anyone to, you know, to gun violence. It's just beastly.
There's some point in one of the stories when you talk about a white friend, I think, who's like 40 and is pretty shaken up because he's just lost somebody.
That was amazing to me. And, you know, I never really thought about that. And that actually sparked many conversations I've had with a lot of friends who aren't from places like where I'm from and how they look at murder or how they look at death. You know, it's the idea of being 40-something years old and never being to a funeral is like, I can't remember my first funeral. It had to be like 4 or 5 years old. And I've been, you know, I even hit I hit a stretch in my life. I think I was like in my early 20s where I was saying, yo, I'm not going to funerals anymore. Like, I'm done with it because I've been to so many.
You start off the book in a sunnier place. Actually, a place that's very familiar to WYPR listeners, a Stoop storytelling event at the Creative Alliance. And you make it clear that what you were expecting Stoop to mean is not what the audience was expecting.
Yeah, you know, it was such a great event, like kind of what we were talking about earlier. Laura and Jessica created something beautiful, and I wish more people from the city, and I'm going to do my job to try to get more people from the city to attend. You know, I think it's really great and transformative. I've always been a student of storytelling before I even knew I was a storyteller.
I'm trying to remember what you said your line was about. This wasn't a Stoop.
Not the Stoop I'm used to.
Because what was missing?
Red cups, blue flashing lights, and, you know, it wasn't my neighborhood.
But you felt like you made a connection with that audience.
Oh, yeah, because that's what great storytelling does. Great storytelling has the power to connect people from all walks of life and help them experience those, you know, that set of universal truths that just connect us all.
Well, who is the audience for these essays in The Beast Side? Who are you writing for?
Everybody in America. Everybody outside of America. And I'm not saying that as like a corny sales pitch, but these essays mean different things to different people. So if you're familiar with these experiences and the things I write about, it's almost like a love story and a testament to document your humanity. Because a lot of times we're just looked at as B-roll footage on the news, you know? Some wild barefoot black kid waving an AK and running through a housing project. You know, that kid doesn't have a story. He doesn't have a family. He doesn't experience love. He doesn't eat ice cream. He's just a thing, right? So if you're used to these experiences or if you know these stories, then, you know, it's you. It's there for you. It's a love story to everything you go through and a little bit of insight on developing the skills to get out of it. Now, if you're a person who aren't familiar with these stories, it's a glimpse into a reality that you can't imagine. And I think that if you read them and you understand them, it'll enhance social relations. It'll help you understand why we as black people feel the way we feel about certain things and why we act certain ways and where do some of our issues come from.
I had the feeling, reading some of these, I had the feeling, thinking of you as a foreign correspondent, that you're sort of explaining to me, taking me into conversations in places that I wouldn't have access to otherwise. And some of it's language barrier, and some of it's culture barrier. I did some work as a foreign correspondent when I was with ABC News, and I kind of knew what that job was, but I didn't know whether that's what you were trying to do.
That's exactly what I was trying to do, because one of the things that hurt us as a people, and I'm not talking about black, I'm talking about as Americans, is the communication barrier. People outside of my neighborhood sometimes have trouble communicating with me. And then also people inside of my neighborhood also have trouble communicating with me. So I try to break those barriers down so we can get a better understanding. And when I say, and when I talk about communication, I'll say this. If Darren Wilson had an understanding of Mike Brown and Mike Brown had an understanding of Darren Wilson and they could communicate, then maybe he would be alive and in college right now, right? This is a guy who doesn't really understand the place where he patrols. And then when I talk about within my own community, I was talking to one of my friends the other day. We were standing near Bethel Court, Douglas Housing Projects by Popeyes in East Baltimore. And he was having a rough day with his lady. He was having a rough day at work. He was trying to tell me the story. And I noticed he just kept saying, something, 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 you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Something, 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 you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? And I told him, I said, I know exactly what you're saying. But part of your frustration comes from you can't communicate. You can't tell me how you feel, and that's a problem.
You write almost exactly that about yourself.
Yeah, I could not effectively communicate. I used to handle problems by busting a Hennessy bottle across someone's head because of a failure of communication. But now I can exercise solution-based thinking and be able to work my way through issues without anger. So a lot of anger that comes from a lot of different places, not just in Black communities, but all of these illiterate places all over America comes from just not being able to communicate.
That's writer Dee Watkins here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the book of essays he just published, The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. So I'm thinking of you as a foreign correspondent. And then about halfway through, because you've kind of got this book organized like a mixtape, there's kind of one side of it of brighter topics and one side that's grittier and bleaker. And I thought, no, this isn't a foreign correspondent. This is a war correspondent. You write a lot about the tensions between Black citizens and police.
Yeah, because I think that some of that language and, I'm not the first person to write about it, but I think I had to put that much into this book because a lot of stuff that exists about African-American relations with police officers, a lot of that work is written in a language that's not accessible to everybody. I wanted to write about those things from the voice of an everyday person, like an everyday guy, not some dense academic type of work, but something that everyone can understand and comprehend, regardless of where you come from.
You also write quite casually about your years in the drug trade.
Mm-hmm.
And you make it clear to us people doing that work are getting up early, they're working hard. It's not an easy way to make money, but you call it the family business.
So there's this politician that was trying to be president a couple of years ago, this guy, super liar named Paul Ryan. And I say a super liar because they fact-checked some of his speeches on shows like The Daily Show and Real Time with Bill Maher, and he's had these amazing stats of telling stacks and stacks of lies within like 20 minutes of speaking. And one day he put out a comment where he said, we have a problem in our inner cities where the people don't want to work. And that was just disgusting and disrespectful to me. It was crazy that he would say something like that because I know the people I know and who I grew up around are some of the hardest working people in America. You can't disrespect them like that. And it doesn't matter if they're doing something legal or illegal. They're outworking everybody. And the reason why I had to frame it like that because, Dr. Carl Alexander, from Johns Hopkins, uh-huh, did The Long Shadow that basically said...
It's the study of...
Yeah, the study of...
The possibility of getting out of poverty.
Yeah,
the worst place to try to get out of poverty.
400 white families and 400 poor white families, 400 poor Black families. And, some of the things he found was... not only does 97% of people in Baltimore born in poverty die in poverty, but a white person with some jail has a better chance of getting a job than a Black person with some college and no jail record. So that Black person with no college, that Black person with some college and no jail record still can't find a job, but he or she still has to make money. And he or she still, they still are going to work hard for that. So I just thought that Paul Ryan was completely out of line with that statement. And, you know, and from my experience, I know a guy who was gutting out houses for $50 a day as his side job on top of working at a rental car place and then doing other like small construction type things. So, you know, and the list goes, I could talk about the multiple jobs that people have under the table and, you know, for whatever company on and on and on and on and on again.
Right. And you're really good at bringing those stories home in these essays. But what you left unresolved for me, and I'm not sure it's unresolved for you, but it was for me, is whether someone like you who made money selling drugs, whether you're in any way responsible for the killings that are so heartbreaking, as you describe them, losing your brother, losing family members. I mean, it's terrible, but it seemed like you're writing it completely separately from your own role in the criminal activity that spawns a lot of that.
You know, I'm quick to say that I've made mistakes in the past, and you know that I have to live with and deal with, and you know I'm my toughest critic. But I never hurt a person. I've never been affiliated with anyone who was shot or murdered or anything like that in my life. And it's hard for me to take responsibility of some of these bigger issues that have nothing to do with me. I was just a small, little, teeny, tiny piece of something that was huge and that went on years before I was born
and
that would probably go on years before I was dead. We don't make guns in my neighborhood. We don't grow cocaine. We don't have the climate, the texture, the fruit. We don't understand how these systems work. These things are brought in by outside factors. And the bigger question to me is, you know, you can put a man on the moon, but you can't stop a boat from Colombia. You know, you can build bionic arms and legs and robotic legs, but you can't stop drugs from coming into our country. So, you know, that's the reason why some of these things go on. Lack of opportunity creates people wanting an escape. You can get an escape two ways, one by using it, the other by selling it. Either way, you're caught up in the same rat race, and there you go.
Do you feel the same way about whether there's some connection between people taking part in selling drugs and the poisonous relationships between police and residents of your neighborhood that you describe?
I don't think people want to sell drugs. I don't think people want to break the law. You know, it's in Baltimore, you have more of a chance, a black person, a white person with some jail has more of a chance of getting a job than a black person with some college. There's nothing else to do. Our government, these businesses, these industries, they're failing. They're failing us. They're not supporting black citizens. There's some crazy stat about African Americans being like 90-something percent more likely to start a business because we don't have access, or, you know, to some of these industries. So a lot of it is just survival and doing what you got to do. And you know what? Honestly, it's not just a black thing. Like if me and you went to Hollywood right now and we had this master plan to just shut down the movie industry, right, and create some type of reality where the people there couldn't leave, and move in a militarized police force, right, and then sprinkle crack on top, you'll get the same thing. You get the same result. Put two rats in a bucket with no food and watch them eat each other. It's the same thing.
Another thing that you write a lot about, in addition to the tensions between police and residents of your neighborhood, is the power of literacy. You say that you have made literacy your mission, and you write that when you learn to read, you said it instantly civilized you. I want people to hear in your voice what you wrote.
I wasn't hooked on books until I read Sister Soldier's The Coldest Winter Ever, Clockers by Richard Price, and a few Sherman Alexie essays. Those books opened up my mind and led to me consuming more and more. My thoughts changed. I developed new ideas, and I was forever transformed. Within months, I went from a guy who solved problems by breaking a bottle over someone's forehead to using solution-based thinking when resolving. Reading instantly civilized me. And if it can work for me, I believe it can work for anybody.
So what does that mean, it can work for anybody? What do you think could come out of a really effective literacy program?
Hundreds of years in this country, you know, for hundreds of years it was illegal for slaves to read, for African Americans to read. Why? You know, why? You know, I ask myself these questions. If you own a plantation, why don't you want your slaves reading? Why are you so upset to the point where you're ready to kill them if they learn how to read? Reading allows people to develop the complex thoughts needed to change their living situations. If more people read, more people would be more aware, alert, and develop the skill set needed to create whatever reality they wanted to create. Whatever reality they want to create can come through becoming a voracious reader. So I think that an effective literacy program could change everything. And I think to do that, we have to, you know, work harder at delivering content that's relevant to our students. If you look at some of the first books I read, you know, that got me excited about reading. When I first came across Clockers, when I first came across Sister Soldier, I was, you know, the coldest winner ever. I was thinking, man, I didn't know you can write like this. These stories, you know, they're telling stories of people that are like me or just like people where I come from. So if these stories are relevant and they're selling books and they're telling really, really good, compelling tales, I can do the same thing. And then that led to me, you know, reading history books and reading poetry and just getting into all these different types of literature. So I think an effective reading program can change everything.
But you write about, I remember one friend who said, it's not for me, I'm too old. Just read me this letter, I want you to read me, but don't expect me to learn to read. It's not for me. It's a pretty deep attitude in the community, the way you describe it.
It has become a part of culture. When I was teaching at Coppin State University, every semester I would get a new group of freshmen in my English 101 class. I would ask them, hey, what are you guys reading? And it's not strange to me that most of them would say nothing. You know, it has become tradition. A lot of kids in America think that reading is boring and, you know, it takes too much work and it's not really valuable. And part of that is the content. If I'm living in a place like East Baltimore and all these magical and wild things are happening every day, and every day is like a movie. Every day, when I was a kid, every day was a movie. Anything could happen. And then I get in school and you give me like some book about Ben Carson's childhood or like Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer, you know, and it's no knock on Mark Twain because as a writer, I get his genius now. But as a 10-year-old kid, no, I have zero interest in a slave painting fences. It's like that. It's nothing honorable or amazing or exciting about that to me being a 10-year-old kid in East Baltimore. So I think that we need to figure out a way to find material that directly relates to our students, get them excited, and then let them explore and find the things that interest them the most.
Well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Have a good time talking about it to people. D. Watkins. His new collection of essays is The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. It's published by Hot Books, a new imprint of Skyhorse Publishers. D. Watkins will be speaking at the Baltimore Book Festival at the Red Emma's tent on Friday, September 25th, and on September 26th at the Ivy Bookstore tent. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, an ancient approach to healthy eating. Stay with us on 88.1 for that.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard. Or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's Monday, and of course, on most Monday mornings, we hear from our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. But this week, we'll be checking in with Judy on Wednesday instead. She'll have her annual preview of the upcoming theater season. That's Wednesday morning here on Maryland Morning. But now, a conversation about the benefits of fermented food. Fermenting is a tradition that goes back thousands of years. From ale to dairy products to fruits and meat, many of the foods that we eat today are rooted in a tradition of fermentation. Things like yogurt or cheese, vinegar or sauerkraut, just to name a few. My guest today has spent more than two decades learning the art of fermentation and writing about and talking about its health benefits. Sander Katz is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Art of Fermentation. He'll be giving a workshop tonight at the Whitelock Community Farm in Reservoir Hill. That's one of the many neighborhood farms throughout Baltimore. And he joins me this morning on the phone. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your show.
Glad to have you. So what does it mean exactly to ferment food?
Well, broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. And, even before specifically knowing about microorganisms, you know, people learned a lot about how to work with them so that rather than decomposing food, they could make food more stable, make food more nutritious, or make food more delicious.
And to ferment it then chemically does exactly what to the food? Is it a matter of sort of injecting a little bad stuff to make it ultimately better?
Well, no. It's not like that at all. You're not injecting in any kind of bad stuff. But, you know, the microorganisms, which are part of all of the plants and all of the animals that make up our food, but the microorganisms that are part of it, begin to digest nutrients. So, you know, one of the great things about fermented foods is that the nutrients are pre-digested. And so, many compounds become available to us as a result of the food being fermented that wouldn't otherwise be available to us without the fermentation.
Okay, so are there other benefits as well? I mean, that's an obvious one, but in terms of health, benefits, what else can you talk about with fermented food?
Sure. There are so many health benefits. I mean, certainly, nutrients and very notably minerals become more bioavailable as a result of the fermentation, but then the fermentation generates additional compounds, including in the case of sauerkraut and other fermented vegetables, these compounds called isothiocyanates that are regarded as anti-carcinogenic. But really what I would consider to be the most profound nutritional benefit would be the bacteria themselves, because, contrary to the war on bacteria and the idea that, bacteria are our enemies, it turns out that we need bacteria in order to function effectively. But we have all this chemical exposure to compounds that are designed to kill bacteria. So when we eat bacterially rich foods, foods with live cultures in them, fermented foods that have not been heated or cooked after their fermentation, we're actually ingesting communities of bacteria. So we're building biodiversity, which can help to improve digestion, improve overall immune function, and some new evidence is actually suggesting that it can even improve mental health.
Interesting. So it is kind of counterfactual. I mean, we think about, we hear about antibiotics, for example, that have become, bacteria resistant, or bacteria have become resistant to certain antibiotics. But what you're suggesting here is that perhaps we're limiting too many bacteria from our systems that could be of benefit.
Well, sure. I mean, there's antibiotic drugs, there's antibacterial cleansing products that have become ubiquitous. There's the chlorine in municipal water systems. I mean, we just all have contact frequently with chemical compounds that diminish biodiversity of bacteria in our intestine.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's Marilyn Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is the author and fermentation revivalist, Sander Katz. So what are the ways that folks can ferment food?
Generally, for someone who's interested in a first experience of fermenting, I recommend starting with fermenting vegetables. I mean, the reasons are that, there's no need to go obtain special starter cultures. The bacteria you need are part of all of the vegetables we eat already. You might decide you want to get a beautiful, elegant crock, but a jar that's already sitting in your pantry is adequate, so you don't really need any special equipment. It's really simple. In just a few minutes, I can really transmit all the information that you need. And you can enjoy your results relatively quickly. There's no waiting for months or years. In really a few days or a week, the food has been transformed by the fermentation. And then finally, there's absolutely no case history of illness or food poisoning. This food is as safe as it gets. And, you know, there is no, you know, case history of troubles at all with fermented vegetables. So in terms of people's fear of working with bacteria and that could be dangerous, fermenting vegetables is as safe as it gets. So I generally recommend that as a great starting point. Plus, it's delicious, supportive of good health, probiotic.
Does it last longer than, say, you know, vegetables that are frozen or vegetables that are, you know, preserved in some other way?
Well, no. I mean, it doesn't last longer than vegetables that are frozen or vegetables that are canned. But what it does is it preserves their nutrients much more effectively. So, you know, I mean, fermentation actually enhances nutrients, and the nutrients are in no way degraded by the process of fermentation, you know, unlike most other methods that we have of food preservation. So, you know, it's a strategy for preserving food, you know, from a season of plenty to get you through a season of relative scarcity. But it's not something that you can leave in your pantry for 15 years. You know, it's more dynamic. It's a life process. It requires you know, a certain amount of ongoing engagement.
And I've read that the intersection for you yourself as a writer and a researcher in this field it intersects with your life in a very poignant and direct way. Tell us how you got interested in fermented foods when you had a diagnosis back in the 90s.
Well, sure. I mean, I've been living, you know, since the early 90s with HIV, and I've certainly seen, you know, fermentation as, you know, part of a strategy for, you know, maintaining good health and overall immune function. You know, I mean, my initial interest in fermentation actually stems from, you know, a childhood growing up in New York City loving sour pickles. You know, but at some point when I started dealing with HIV, you know, I started reading about some of the immune stimulating benefits of eating, you know, live bacterial cultures. And I mean, fermented foods are not a cure for HIV. They're not necessarily a cure for cancer. But by helping to improve overall digestion and immune stimulation and overall immune function, you know, it's really part of how I keep myself healthy.
Sander Katz is the author of The Art of Fermentation. He'll be at the Whitelock Community Farm in Reservoir Hill tonight at 5 o'clock leading a workshop about fermentation. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Well, Mr. Katz, thanks so much. I appreciate it, and enjoy the workshop tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for us today on Maryland Morning. On Wednesday, we'll have J. Wynn Russick's season preview of all things theatrical, and I'll speak with the Newbery Medal-winning author Laura Amy Schlitz about her new book. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production of
Your Public Radio,
WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1814, by the dawn's early light, Francis Scott Key saw that the American flag still waved over Fort McHenry. The poem the 35-year-old lawyer wrote became the lyrics to The Star-Spangled Banner, which was recognized in 1931 as the United States national anthem. We're back on Wednesday. Please join us.